Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're going to have a very special conversation today with an American patriot who has stepped forward to raise an alarm about a problem that we've been talking about a bit on this program of late, but that he has been way ahead of the power curve in understanding and raising the alarm about. This is the idea of having the World Health Organization's Director General in charge of critical parts of America's public health policy, specifically with respect to emergency crises, pandemics, and the like. We're going to talk with James Rogowski in just a second, but before we do, I just wanted to give you some introductory thoughts of my own. Javier Becerra is the 25th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He may, effectively, be the last. After all, if an official delegation he's leading to the upcoming World Health Assembly in Geneva succeeds, the Biden administration will contract out America's public health policy to the Chinese Communist Party. What could possibly go wrong? Team Biden wants the Director General of the World Health Organization henceforth to determine whether there are public health emergencies of international concern in this country, and if so, what we are going to do about them. Now, the Chinese communists picked the incumbent, Dr. Tedros, who unfailingly does their bidding. And if you like the China model of lockdowns, vaccine mandates, and digital health passports, you'll love Becerra's successor. If not, join us at stopvaxpassports.org in telling your elected representatives to end this insane voluntary surrender of our national sovereignty and security. With that, let me introduce James Rogowski. He is an American patriot, but a very thoughtful man who has now for some years been raising the specter of real threats to our country, to our security, to our sovereignty, to our people, to their health, for that matter. In a series of websites that he's created over the years, each of which, it appears, has now been taken down. Tens of thousands of hours of work have been thereby eliminated. Unless you go to the Wayback Machine, or follow his work these days at Substack. And I'm very pleased to have a chance to talk with him at some length. I heard him doing an interview with our friend Steve Bannon the other day and was so delighted to hear what he was warning about, and, well, not delighted about the warnings, needless to say, but delighted that somebody is doing the warnings and specifically doing it in a very thoughtful, articulate, and informed way. So, James Rogowski, welcome to Securing America. It is so good to have you with us, and thank you again for the work that you've taken on. And I apologize on behalf of all of us that you have had such a difficult time, as you put it, speaking truth to power. But we're going to invite you to do it right here.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you can hear me okay. It does seem like our connection might be a little bit choppy, so please let me know if there's a problem. It's not about me. Once you know you focus on the messenger, you lose sight of the message. And the beauty with what I'm hoping to present to everyone who listen is evidence. It's not about my opinion. I certainly have opinions, but I do everything I can to separate opinion from fact. And what happened after getting reassigned, I'll put it that way, the Grandmaster Plan of the Universe obviously had a different plan for me other than what I was doing. I found documents that are in the public domain. I'm not a hacker. I didn't have access to any kind of confidential information. I merely did what most people would count as a very boring job of reading through documents in the Federal Register or documents, law from years past, or documents that are on the WHO website that anyone can access. And all I'm doing is collecting those public documents and extracting literally the needles in the haystack of all of these words to point out something that the mainstream media doesn't want you to know. And I'll keep going. You interrupt when you have a question, by all means.
I am going to jump in every once in a while. Let me just ask, and I take your point about the messenger. I'm simply calling attention to the work of this particular messenger to thank you for doing it, for taking it on voluntarily and obviously with not a little difficulty. But let's talk about specifically the public information that you have been putting forward of late about this idea that I mentioned in my commentary that the United States government under the Biden administration is intent in about, 8 or so days from now to surrender a critical piece of our sovereignty, namely our ability to identify and declare public health emergencies and to decide what we are going to do about them. And again, this isn't really an abstraction in terms of both the nature of this kind of decision and its implications, because we've just been living through a public health crisis and dealing as best we can, I guess, or maybe not, with it on the basis of our own representative government and its, elected officials primarily. So talk us through what is the Biden administration proposing to do that would be such a departure from that?
What I want to do is talk about the history all the way back, but what I'm going to do is give the punchline first, okay? And so what I found was that in these amendments, there literally was one line that is changing existing regulations and it's, crossing it out, there's a strike through on this line, and it literally looked like a needle in a haystack of words. And the line that's being removed with, many, many, many other changes is something that says that the WHO must get the agreement of the nation that is, dealing with whatever the problem may be, or the WHO can't do a darn thing. If the nation, is sovereign and it tells the WHO, we disagree, the WHO puts its tail between its legs, goes home, and that's the end of that. They're not even allowed to talk about it, okay? And so if you remove that requirement that the sovereign nation, have the final say, you use the proper word. You're surrendering that bit of your sovereignty over to what would then be the dictator general of what I call the World Hypnosis Organization. You go all the way back to Roman times, and what the word itself means, dictator means someone who dictates, right? And in an emergency, in Roman times, they would choose a pillar of the society, a well-respected statesman, to step in, take charge, make things happen. If you have an emergency, you need that kind of action. Now, you still do not have authority to trample on people's inalienable rights, but you need that sort of take charge person. You can't wait for committee meetings and all that sort of thing. But then the person backs off.
All right, Jim, hold on one second. This is a critical point on which I need to return after a very short break. We'll be right back with more with James Rogowski about the World Health Organization and your public health and safety right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Xavier Becerra is the 25th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He may effectively be the last.
After all, if an official delegation he's leading to the upcoming World Health Assembly in Geneva succeeds, the Biden administration will contract out America's public health policy to the Chinese Communist Party. Team Biden wants the Director General of the World Health Organization henceforth to determine whether there are public health emergencies of international concern in this country, and if so, what we are going to do about them. The Communist Chinese pick the incumbent, who unfailingly does their bidding. If you like the China model of lockdowns, vaccine mandates, and digital health passports, you'll love Becerra's successor. If not, join us at StopVaxPassports.org in telling your elected representatives to end this insane voluntary surrender of our national sovereignty and security. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with James Roguski. He is a man who has a mission, and it's a mission of speaking truth to power, and I'm delighted to have a chance to help amplify his doing that, specifically about an issue that is weighing on me and I think increasingly others across this country, thanks in part to Jim's work, namely an impending voluntary surrender of our national sovereignty and arguably our security to a wholly unaccountable international body called the World Health Organization that is known to be dominated under its present leadership, particularly by the Chinese Communist Party. And Jim, we were beginning to get sort of the essence of this problem from you, but let's back the lens up a little bit to give us a sense of what is the World Health Organization? What was its initial charter? How has the United States government, become associated with it and essentially set the stage for this so-called World Health Assembly meeting that's coming up in a little bit over a week's time in Geneva?
I'll try to run through, hundreds of years of history as short a period of time as possible. On June 14th, 1948, after Congress passed a joint resolution, it was signed by Harry Truman, and so we agreed to join the WHO. But, what Exhibit A on my website is that document, and it says very clear English. I mean, Harry Truman and back then people spoke more straightforwardly. It said, we'll join the WHO, that's wonderful, we'll be a part of the international community, but nothing that they do, nothing has any requirement upon the United States to change any of our laws. And so that's actually reflected in Article 61 of the International Health Regulations, which says even if amendments are made, they don't have to be accepted by any individual member of the World Health Organization. We will have a six-month right of refusal, whereby each nation in the world could just say, well, thank you very much, WHO. We don't like these amendments. They don't have any impact upon us. And that is such a simple thing, but politically it's different. So what we're likely to be faced with is the six-month period after this assembly, where if the assembly does approve the amendments, this is going to be a political football kicked around. Does the American public and do the people who are running for office agree that we, the United States, and for that matter, any country in the world, should surrender our ability to determine and control whether or not we live under a dictatorial state of emergency? Should we be the ones who decide that? Or should Tedros Ghebreyesus, the dictator of the world, have that power to just at his whim declare an emergency and all of the things that come after that?
Well, Jim, this does sound like a tremendous departure from the original concept and the understanding of the United States. You've called him the dictator general. Of course, his formal title is director general of the World Health Organization. But these amendments, and I want you to just quickly give us a sense of this process that's afoot now. These amendments would effectively give him dictatorial powers with respect to so-called public health emergencies of international concern. So give us a sense of the process that's afoot here, and specifically the role that Xavier Becerra, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, will be playing.
I apologize in advance for the complexity of it, but what I can try to do is explain it and simplify it. And it starts with the definition of terms, okay? The word pandemic, I don't use it other than to say it's not defined in the law that I know of anywhere. So I don't use the word pandemic. And then there's this cascade of terminology where, as you said, the WHO talks about a public health emergency of international concern, which, you know, they telegraph their action, PHEIC, they can declare a fake. They also want to be able to declare a FERC, PHERC, public health emergency of regional concern. Not only do they want to make the director general into the dictator general, they want to give their regional directors the freedom and the capability of declaring emergencies region by region, you know, the Americas, Africa, Asia, Europe, Australia, that kind of thing. Now, when you come forth to the United States, almost everybody is confused. There is a national emergency that can be declared by the president. That is, you know, we're familiar with that. You know, there's various events, hurricanes and all that kind of thing. That is a one-year set term. Once the president declares it, it can go for a year. And there, we're currently under 42 separate emergencies that most people are unaware of, going all the way back to the Iran hostage crisis in the 70s. And so Congress is obligated by law every 6 months to voice the will of the people, to tell the president through a joint resolution that they're supposed to vote on, yes, we agree with you, we should keep this emergency, or no, we should not, and it should stop. And they've just abdicated their obligation completely. 42 different times a year, you know, twice a year. And so that's a national emergency. Then it cascades down into the worst beast of all. And, you know, we'll talk about Javier Becerra's role in this. The public health emergency is declared by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. It only runs for 90 days, but it can be renewed, you know, infinitely. It's already been renewed for 10 times. And there's no, the COVID, and there's no way to turn it off. Javier Becerra is, you know, health dictator for life in the United States, but nobody's paying attention to the fact that the CARES Act, health emergency, and the CARES Act are intimately linked together, where as long as there's a public health emergency, all of the money flows, and it is tied into the emergency use authorizations for the testing, the PCR testing, the rapid antigen testing, all kinds of treatments that, you know, most people are unaware of that are ungodly expensive, you know, various medications and the injections. The money flows because of the emergency that nobody will turn off because the money flows.
Right. So, as you said, this is a bit complicated. There are different levels of emergency declarations and authorizations that flow from them. I guess the key point is that, at least in theory, national decisions unique to the United States are made by people who are, at least theoretically, accountable to us. They work for us. We pay their salaries. The Congress is overseeing their activities, or at least is supposed to. What's different about this World Health Organization gambit, and again, we're going to get into more detail on the other side of a short break, who is giving the WHO, the World Health Organization, these expanded powers to make decisions about our internal emergency decisions and the implementation of those decisions in the way of, well, you know, the various kinds of procedures that we've seen in the course of this this pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to talk about all of that with James Rogowski momentarily, and in the course of that, I hope give you a better feeling for what are the stakes if we don't turn off this surrender of our national sovereignty being brought to us by the Biden administration, and expected to be formalized sometime between the 22nd and 28th of May in Geneva, just a few days from now. So pay attention, stay tuned, and more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with James Rogowski. He is a researcher, an analyst, a patriot who has been raising alarm for now some time about what's been going on in our country, pursuant to various degrees of authority from our national government in response to the COVID crisis. But of late, he has been raising a specific alarm about the prospect that decisions concerning such emergencies, or perhaps emergencies that don't actually have anything to do with disease, let alone pandemics, might be essentially contracted out to the director general, or as he calls him, the dictator general, of the World Health Organization. Wholly unaccountable to us, and actually a man who is known to be in the pocket of the Chinese Communist Party. So, Jim, there are so many important avenues to go down here, and we only have a little bit of time to do so. Cut to the chase, if you would, and talk about this imminent meeting of something called the World Health Assembly. The amendments we've been referring to now several times that have been advanced by the Biden administration, and what Xavier Becerra is expected to do as the leader of our delegation in Geneva to secure the approval of these very problematic amendments.
As far as anyone can tell, the proper procedures by which any kind of international agreement are meant to be negotiated don't seem to have been followed. You know, who's responsible for this? Well, ultimately, the responsibility lies with the president. But as a general rule, the Secretary of State is responsible for negotiating, you know, diplomatic agreements. But it appears that most of this is happening by not duly authorized people. We haven't been able to find that either the president or the Secretary of State has authorized the negotiators, has authorized Lois Pace, who presented it, has authorized the mission of global affairs. And so the biggest issue behind all of this is the fact that it has just been hidden completely from view. There's no public comment. There's no discussion in Congress. There's no clarity that we can find in the Federal Register that, you know, these are the authorized negotiators and so forth. And yes, Javier Becerra is the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, but that doesn't mean he has the authority to conduct international, you know, agreements. Now, that authority may very well have been passed, but, you know, no one is presenting it. And so the amendments were presented and pretty much hidden. We could never find that they were ever published anywhere on a United States website. They popped up very quietly, and this is how they do it. You know, they stick it up on a website and they expect you to just be watching for it. Well, I happened to notice that they had done that. And then it just disappeared. There's been zero media about this. People are confused by other things and distracted by this talk of a pandemic treaty in the distance. Forget about that. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about amendments to the regulations. And my assumption is that what they were hoping, is very similar to what they did with the Obamacare Affordable Care Act, Nancy Pelosi famously said, you know, yeah, it's 1,000-plus pages. You can read it after you pass it. And so I'm actually, you know, and how long does it take you to read it, and how long does it take you to comprehend it? And so taking the world view just beyond our borders, 194 nations are going to be sending delegations, and my heart actually goes out to those people. They have no idea of the trap that they are walking into. They most likely have not read it. I haven't seen where the WHO has actually translated it into the languages that they're supposed to. But be that as it may, you know, have these people actually read the amendments before they're going to vote on them? Or are they just going to be, you know, an automaton puppet, you know, with their strings being pulled to show up in Geneva and vote for something that, you know, maybe they don't read until they get back home to their country? And at that point, they could be a hero to their nation if they said, well, you know, look at this. This is giving up our sovereignty. I can't vote for that. But if they blindly vote for it, you know, they're looking at potential treasonous charges against them for not having the authority to purport to give away their sovereignty. And so I want to know, I want to know, you know, who authorized Javier Becerra to give away control of whether or not we as a nation determine whether or not we think we have an emergency. Because I certainly don't feel like we have an emergency at the moment, but yet we're living under emergency dictatorial rules.
And again, there's so many other things to ask about here, but just for a moment, go back to 1948 when the Congress authorized our participation in the World Health Organization, and a very important clause in that authorization resolution that bears on what's being done right now, I think, in a rather important way.
Absolutely, and it's Exhibit A on, you know, if you go to stopthewho.com and click, makes it very clear, the language is precise. There is nothing in our agreement to join the WHO that requires us to do anything if we don't want to. But that doesn't stop an administration from agreeing to do things that they want to agree to. Now, I will take you back to something that we haven't discussed. I'll keep it very brief. On the very last day of the Obama administration, the Center for Disease Control dropped into the Federal Register an 84-page final ruling that changed the definition of a public health emergency in the United States. And it says, the wording is atrocious. It basically says if Tedros Ghebreyesus, or whoever is the dictator general of the WHO, even makes a recommendation about something, then we could declare an emergency. And it's just the most absurd piece of writing that I've ever seen. And I'm just trying to shed light on it so people look at it and realize that that's what the Obama administration did on their very last day in office.
So there's history here. And everybody, I think, who's been watching the Biden administration understands it's at least a continuation of the Obama presidency. Some say it's Obama's third term. Many of the people in positions of responsibility in the Biden administration had similar, if not identical, positions in the previous Obama years. But what you're describing, Jim, is that the president of the United States, or people working for him at least, now are poised to have amendments that they've made that would essentially entrust to the director general, dictator general, if you will, of the World Health Organization, responsibilities for declaring what is a public health emergency of international concern, and to direct what will be done in response to it, not only to nations elsewhere around the world, but to our own as well. And that at least under existing arrangements and arguably international law, they will have the authority somehow to enforce these decisions if we decide, we're not interested in going into lockdown, or we're not interested in having people brought into our country from overseas because the World Health Organization Director General says you mustn't impose travel bans, or you must impose vaccine mandates or passports for that matter, or perhaps in matters that have nothing to do with disease, gun violence, for example, or climate change. The World Health Organization is going to start telling us what we have to do to mitigate so-called public health emergencies of international concern. Have I got that right?
All of that is right, but earlier in what you said, you said I'm describing something, okay? Let me be abundantly clear, okay? Let me be abundantly clear. I've pledged an allegiance to this country. I've never held an oath. I've never had held a political office or appointed office, so I have not, taken the official oath of office. But all of the people in those positions, please realize that what we are trying to share with those people in the military, in government, and so forth, is that you have an oath of office to defend the Constitution. And what we're telling you is that you're getting a week or so advance notice of what certainly looks like treason. What are you going to do about it? The people are speaking out saying, we do not agree with this. We do not agree with giving away, surrendering our sovereignty. And every congressperson, everyone who has ever held any kind of office, police officers, sheriffs around this nation, you have an oath of office to defend the Constitution. Will you start doing it? Look at the evidence. Don't take my word for it. Don't believe anything I have to say. Look at it for yourself. Use your own judgment.
Right.
But you have an oath to defend the Constitution.
Well said. Couldn't be more important, and something that I hope our audience will resonate to. Jim, how can they find out the kind of information that you're making available and disseminate it further, including to their elected officials?
It's public information. I just make it easy to find and understand. Go to stopthewho.com and click on the link that says, here's the evidence. You go down there, you scroll to where it says evidence, and then it's exhibit A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Fantastic. We have to leave it at that, Jim. You can also go to StopVaxPassports, VAXPassports.org, for direct action with your elected officials. I encourage you to do that as well. Jim, thank you very much for your time today. Come back to us again soon with updates if you would. Next up, the great Monica Crowley. We'll talk with her about this and more right after this.
The This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Xavier Becerra is the 25th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He may effectively be the last. After all, if an official delegation he's leading to the upcoming World Health Assembly in Geneva succeeds, the Biden administration will contract out America's public health policy to the Chinese Communist Party. Team Biden wants the Director General of the World Health Organization henceforth to determine whether there are public health emergencies of international concern in this country, and if so, what we are going to do about them. The Communist Chinese pick the incumbent, who unfailingly does their bidding. If you like the China model of lockdowns, vaccine mandates, and digital health passports, you'll love Becerra's successor. If not, join us at StopVaxPassports.org in telling your elected representatives to end this insane voluntary surrender of our national sovereignty and security. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And when I say welcome to our next guest, I don't mean just welcome like it's nice to see you or thanks for dropping by. I mean welcome, because she's one of my dearest friends, a colleague of many years, and a person that I've come to admire tremendously for all she does for our country in any number of capacities. Now, praise God, including a podcast. And lots of people have podcasts, but Monica Crowley's is apparently taking the world by fire, which is just exactly what one would want, because what she has to say about, well, just about anything is worth listening to and always tremendously informative as well as inspiring. She is also frequently seen on various television platforms, Fox News among them, and I'm pleased to say here at Real America's Voice, Steve Bannon's program, and now ours, praise God. Welcome, really welcome, Monica Crowley, to Securing America. Great to have you.
Oh, Frank, my longtime dear friend, thank you so much for having me today. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Great. Let me ask you, first of all, to just tell us a little bit about the podcast, what you're doing with it, how people can find it, and why they better be paying attention.
Well, thank you very much for the question, Frank. And it's always a joy to talk about my new project, which is the Monica Crowley Podcast. That's what it's called. It's not a particularly creative name for it. But you know what? We are in an existential fight for the country, Frank, which means we have no time for niceties, right? Or creativity. It's just get right to the point to save the country we love so much. So it's called the Monica Crowley Podcast. I'm doing it 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. So Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you download your podcast, you just go there, type in Monica Crowley Podcast. It'll come up. Just click right on subscribe. It's free. And if you hit subscribe, each show will automatically download to your phone, so you won't miss a minute. And I guarantee you, you will love every show, because we are out here saving the country every day, but we're also having a good time doing it.
You have been a multimedia phenomenon in the private sector. You've had a talk radio show forever, WABC, among other outlets. You have been the author of a terrific best-selling book, What the Bleep Just Happened. You've also served our country in government, in the Treasury Department, as the press secretary for the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, during the Trump administration. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that at some point, and it could get bloody because of my issues, shall we say, with your old boss over the years. But I wanted to ask you specifically about something that I think probably touches you personally, Monica, and that is the prospect that former government employees like yourself, serving ones in uniform and on the civilian side, are now being told that they're going to have an opportunity to invest in mutual funds without being told by the thrift savings plan that they might be investing in communist Chinese companies in the process. What are your thoughts on the advisability of investing in China from an investor's point of view, but also from a national security point of view?
Yeah. You know, Frank, I'm so glad that you're covering this issue, and I'm delighted to be able to comment on it myself, because when you become a federal government employee, like I was, you're automatically enrolled in something called the Thrift Savings Plan, which is essentially the retirement account for federal government employees, and as you point out, civilian and military alike. So I was taking part in the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan, while I was in the federal government. And then a little bit after, when I left and there was a change of administration, I still had that plan. And it was ongoing. But I talked to my accountant, I talked to others, and I actually liquidated my holdings in the Thrift Savings Plan and moved it into a private sector account, because I didn't want any part of what they were doing. Not that it was particularly bad, but I wanted to have greater control over my money that was sitting in that account. So I'm no longer part of TSP. To your question, there are tens of millions of people who are former and current federal government employees who are now faced with the prospect that there will be an end run around two presidential directives. Both President Trump and, to his credit, President Biden continued this block on investing these government employees' money into companies that are either owned or controlled by our mortal enemy, the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party. So we have these presidential directives in place, Frank, and you know this because you've been covering this and raising this alarm bell. But now it looks like they may actually open a window for a mutual fund that will be a go-around to those presidential directives, whether these government employees know it or not, whether they're aware or not, but that their money that will then be invested in propping up these companies that are either actively involved in circumventing our national security and or engaged in China's egregious human rights abuses. And I think if most government employees knew that, they wouldn't want their money or their future retirement invested in these Chinese CCP-controlled or owned companies. It is appalling. It is a moral outrage. And on top of that, Frank, it's a national security threat.
I couldn't agree more, Monica. I couldn't have said it better, but thank you for saying it here. And especially, we've just done a really impressive webinar on this subject with, among others, your friend and mine, Roger Robinson, who talked about, you know, the implications of this in terms of, well, possibly compromising these individuals, you know, working in government, in our executive branch, on Capitol Hill, in the military. General Jerry Boykin was also one of our guests, and he said, you know, this would be, no kidding, the kind of thing you'd have to report on your security clearance forms or your financial disclosures. And it would raise a question as to whether you're having the kind of contact with our enemy that would be disqualifying. Monica, we have to take just a short break. We're going to come right back with more. And I want to ask you more broadly about China. You've studied it closely. You worked with the guy who opened the door to it, Richard Nixon. And we're going to get your thoughts as to what, well, he would be thinking about it. More with the great Monica Crowley right after this. Welcome back to a continuing conversation with the great Monica Crowley, star of the Monica Crowley podcast, among many other things, and always a welcome guest here. Monica, we were talking about China, and we were talking about what, well, the so-called masters of the universe have been doing to their great benefit financially, it must be said, not so much to that of other investors, to actually underwrite what the Chinese Communist Party has called itself people's war against our country through a technique known as unrestricted warfare, which has all kinds of elements to it, as you know. You worked for a time after he left the presidency for Richard Nixon. He was, of course, the man who, during his presidency, famously, was Nixon went to China. He opened the doors to a relationship with the Chinese Communist Party that I think he believed at the time, and many did, would be mutually beneficial and conduce to, over time, positive changes in China to the benefit of the world, not just the U.S. and China as specifically. The question to you is, and I don't know it's speculative, but I'm going to take you out on a limb. Were Richard Nixon alive today? Were he witnessing what China has become and what is being done to aid and abet what it seeks to do? Do you think he might feel differently about the whole proposition of this opening to China?
I thank you for that question, Frank, because it's such an important one, and I do get asked it a lot, and it is speculative, but I think it's important to speculate how he would think about the problem now and what he would believe and what he would be advising his successors, whether it's Joe Biden or anybody else, Donald Trump, about how to handle China. I want to take one quick step back and just put into historical context Nixon's opening to China, because that will then inform my answer about how we would feel about the strategic competition, our strategic adversary, China, now. And keep in mind, my belief is, and you and I have talked about many threats to the United States over the years, but my view is it's China and everybody else. Not to minimize the Iranian nuclear threat, not to minimize terrorist organizations and their threats, but it's China and then everybody else in terms of the hierarchy of threats threatening the United States right now. Just to take one step back, you will recall that when Nixon opened the door to China in 1972, which then framed the relationship for the next several decades, it was in the context of growing Soviet power. So the Soviet Union was really ramping up its military, acquiring newer classes of nuclear weapons, modernizing their nuclear arsenal and so on at the time. And the United States was so strapped by the Vietnam War that we could not match either politically or economically, militarily, we could not match what the Soviets were doing at the time. So the thinking behind the opening to China was twofold. One, to counterbalance growing Soviet power, and two, to try to enlist the CCP in ending the war in Vietnam. So that was the thinking behind the opening to China, and it was a brilliant strategic move at the time. The subtext to all of it is, as you say, that Nixon and others, many others who still buy into this theory, although I think it's been discredited, is that if we help China open to the world, that the pressure being brought to bear on the CCP to liberalize both democratically, politically, and economically, and in terms of human rights, that pressure would become so intense that we would either see the CCP liberalize on its own to maintain power, or we would see the people so emboldened and strengthened that they would overthrow the regime and we would have a democratic China. As we now know, that didn't pan out that way. It did not come to pass. And Nixon, when he passed away in 1994, was already starting to be disappointed by the fact that we weren't seeing this kind of pressure. He thought, you know, if the Chinese people had choice in their economic lives, that would logically extend to choice, a demand for choice in their political lives. And we have not seen that come to pass. Richard Nixon was nothing if not adaptable to how the world was changing over time. And in fact, when I worked for him, Frank, he wrote a new foreign policy oriented book every 2 years because he wanted to make sure
that it's not a little help from you, let the record show.
The last two books. Yes, I was there for those last two books. But he wanted to make sure that he and the United States and the Western world were staying 2 steps or 10 steps ahead of the bad guys and where the world was headed. He also, and as an example of this, and Frank, this is how you and I met, you came to speak to President Nixon along with Roger Robinson to lobby him to back away from the ABM treaty, which he signed as president, but then the Soviet Union collapsed. So the other signatory to that treaty no longer existed. Nixon was persuaded by those arguments and came out publicly for the scrapping of the ABM treaty, which we later saw under President George W. Bush, I believe, who scrapped it finally. Okay, so that is just another example of Nixon's adaptability. So that's a long way of setting context for what I'm about to say. I do think that Richard Nixon, if he were alive today, he would be outraged and appalled by the behavior of the CCP. He would understand it. They're communists. They want world domination and they want to defeat, that's right, and they want to defeat the United States and the Western world and the freedom that we all represent and stand for. So he would be disappointed that China didn't take the more productive path, but he would also, in a very clear-eyed way, Frank, he would see China as our number one adversary. He would understand the extent and nature of the threat that China poses economically, militarily, geostrategically, politically, and in terms of human rights.
Monica, and we didn't get to the World Health Organization, so let's do it again very soon if we can. And in the meantime, thank you for your great work now at the Monica Crowley Podcast. I hope everyone will check it out, as well as, of course, continue checking out this program, Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped as a result of watching this program to do just that, and that you will look for more information at securingamerica.tv. And of course, follow me at Frank Gaffney. But most importantly, go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.